Welcome to Shovel Talk, a podcast for economic developers from your friends at the Golden Shovel Agency.
Hello, producer Darren Varley back with another episode of Shovel Talk. This episode, we have a conversation with Donald T. Yannone, PhD and author of America's Dream at a Crossroads, the 2024 presidential election and beyond. So I guess this is a bit of a timely topic, you might say. Mr. Yannone is a professor who has created economic development strategies for over 40 communities. His latest book explores what it means to achieve the American dream for diverse generations and people and how economic developers, you, can help them achieve it and the foundational importance of democracy and freedom. And then that old question many of us have asked ourselves, how do you define the American dream? Can't wait to hear this one. So Bethany, take it away.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Shovel Talk. My name is Bethany Quinn, and I am joined here today by Donald Yannone, who is a professor and author and has a history in economic development. So we're really going to have an exciting conversation today. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Bethany. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, before I get going into asking you questions, I'm going to give everyone a little bit of a brief bio on you. So just so everyone knows, Don has recently released a book, America's Dream at a Crossroads, the 2024 presidential election and beyond. In that book, he argues the American dream should be the defining issue in the 2024 presidential election and remain a major focus beyond the election. Now, I think that's something that every economic developer can agree with. The American dream and the ability to achieve it is something that I know defines so much of our work. Before we dig in, though, I'd really like to know, even for myself, Don, what is your background that makes you the right person to write a book on the American dream?
Well, I think for any writer, it's passion. And I am a writer, so I do it for that reason. But I spent 40 years in economic development and public policy, working in 32 states, 10 countries, and on 10 Indian reservations. So I spent a lot of time working with communities and businesses and people on trying to advance the American dream, which we understood at that time as being economic development. So I think that does. Plus, you know, I am an experienced writer and author. So I felt I could use my writing skills as a way to tell the story that is in this book.
That's great. And I think it's really interesting that you have such diverse experience in regards to the communities and the groups that you have worked in. You know, the American dream is not something that's homogenous, right? It should be available to everyone. And your diverse background, I think, also situates you to address that.
I appreciate you saying that.
I also think that your background in anthropology is really interesting. I noticed that that was the first degree that you've earned. You have, it looks like, a couple master's degrees and a PhD, so one of many. But I think that anthropology background is certainly unique and interesting. And I was wondering about your perspective on the importance of understanding local cultures and societies as an economic developer.
Well, you're the first person who has ever asked me that question, and I'm delighted that you did.
Oh, good. And hey, point for me.
It is. And so I think what anthropology taught me was culture and understanding of how values and beliefs give shape to whether it's an organization or whether it's a community or whether it's a family. And so it taught me a great deal about the cultural context, which in today's world, we really see that coming into play very often, which we have the political extremes, but also just the great diversity in American society in every way that we can imagine it. But the other thing that I learned from economic development, from anthropology that applies to economic development is the concept of evolution and how things change and evolve, how they emerge. And I think that that's a powerful idea that goes alongside culture.
There's so much that we could dig into here. It's actually really fascinating. I mean, just based on your answer, a couple of things come to mind. when you talk about shifting ideals and cultural influences, one of the things that we're looking at right now, obviously, is the resurgence of manufacturing and onshoring. And I think there is that anthropological lens as well to look at, right? I mean, you go back into the history of the United States and the important role that manufacturing played, and then how it's almost like that got stripped out of our culture and society, and now we're working so hard to bring that back. How fascinating, if you look at the history, how does that play into the American dream?
Well, you know, manufacturing has played an enormous role in enabling several generations of Americans to achieve the American dream. My father was a prime illustration of that as a millwright and mechanic, and he was able to advance and, you know, provide what all of us needed through manufacturing. And my grandfather, that is my dad's father, was very much rooted in the early days of steel and railroads. He came to America in search of the American dream in 1904 at the age of 15, and found the American dream and was able to support his family in line with this vision of what the dream was all about in the 1920s and the 1930s. So manufacturing has always been incredibly important to me for personal reasons. And the Ohio Valley area across from Wheeling, West Virginia, where I grew up, was, you know, a prime area for manufacturing, with the steel mills, the coal mines, and all the related manufacturing that took place. So that really supported the growth of communities and families in the Ohio Valley for many generations. But when you talk about reshoring today, you know, I will comment on that. I think it is a wonderful thing. And I look at it through the lens of business. I'm going back into the business classroom and really what's happening there. I think it's an incredibly return to reality, if you will, because, you know, we've gone crazy in this whole tech economy. So there's a sense of rootedness. And I think manufacturing returns us to place, which I think is incredibly important in economic development. But we need to rebalance. And for national security reasons, it's important to have our productive capabilities in place here.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea that that can happen with a snap of the finger would be great, right? But if it could, we wouldn't be having these workforce shortage issues. And I think that's where, you know, we go back to the anthropological discussion and culture, and how do we reincorporate, I think, for one, that sense of rootedness with everything that has moved, you know, to digital and to cloud-based. And for two, just re-sparking that interest in our young people. That's definitely something that I think we're grappling with industry-wide.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I know that your company is well aware of that. And I know that, you know, many economic developers share the understanding that you've expressed. So I think that manufacturing is going to find itself back into a prominent place in our economy. It's a different kind of manufacturing, as we know. I mean, I remember when, you know, the whole computerization first hit manufacturing. It was all CAD/CAM. It was computer-aided manufacturing and design. And so now it's so much more with the introduction of robots, and we have obviously artificial intelligence and quantum computing that plays a huge role in making manufacturing what it is today. But I'm very excited about that. And I think that that is a central part to the American dream in the past. And I think it can be in the future.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting because when you look at the automation manufacturing, you know, there's a lot of conversations around robotics and whether that's going to take away jobs. And I don't think so. Obviously, none of us can tell the future, but I subscribe to The Economist. I read it every day. I'm a little bit ridiculous about it. And there was a really interesting article that came out just last week talking about how if there's too much in terms of robotics introduced into a setting like manufacturing, it actually disincentivizes workers because people take value from a job well done, essentially, right? So
yes,
making sure that we have that combination of technology and people skills, I don't think is going to go away. I don't think we're going to say, for example, have only one or two people in a warehouse full of robots. So that workforce issue is going to still need to be top priority, I think, as we continue to bring more manufacturing on shore.
Yes, it's going to be a blend and a hybrid. You know, I was talking to a gentleman whose name I can't remember right now, but it's all about, you know, the new approaches to transportation, smart transportation, and all the things that have emerged, you know, from, you know, the use of these robots and delivering pizzas on college campuses to, you know, all the new things that are changing parking meters in downtown. And so it's just, it's really important to almost every sector. And, you know, I think transportation is a major one for opportunity. It's one that Ohio is looking to from an economic development growth standpoint. But I think it's going to be a blend. I would agree with you. I think we have a lot of catching up to do. And one of the concerns that I have is that, you know, sometimes we use old rules to judge new situations, and that doesn't always work. And I think it's important in that sense that people visualize their career in much more dynamic terms. You know, like my dad saw his job initially as a mechanic and then a millwright. And that's all he could see. And he, fortunately, there were a lot of opportunities for him, you know, during his career, so he could be that. But I don't think that's the case. I look at LinkedIn. I look at just how the jobs that are advertised and the people that are competing for those jobs, they're so different than what I could remember, you know, going back 10 years, 20 years ago. But, you know, LinkedIn is a perfect illustration of where the world of work is. And I realize that has more of a professional emphasis, but there's a lot of other jobs attached to those professionals that we see there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's good stuff. I'm glad that your company is giving voice to all these things. I really am. You have great.
Yeah. Thank you, Don. Yeah. We definitely believe in the mission of empowering economic developers and elevating the entire community. So for those who are not familiar with Golden Shovel, we have a free resource learning library that we're constantly adding to, that we don't charge anybody to access any of those things. So a lot of economic developers, actually, we have heard from them that they started a job and they will actually educate themselves through our resource learning library. And that's very rewarding for us because although, of course, we are a for-profit company, we believe that if everyone is more educated and empowered, all of our communities benefit. So thank you for those kind words. We appreciate it.
Well, I remember the words of Wilbur Thompson, who was labeled as the father of urban economics. And I had the chance to work with Wilbur when I was at Cleveland State University. He used a term that, and you described your library, so that's why I bring this up. He described the library as the university for many communities. Mm-hmm. And that's true. I mean, what you're doing is you can do it all over the world, you know, with your virtual resources, but libraries in a physical sense and now in a network sense are, for many communities, they are the university. And I think that that's a role in society that Carnegie and all others that followed with the library, public library movement, you know, it's just so important and it continues to be important.
Oh, absolutely. And for a lot of rural communities we work with, the library is a place for learning. It's also where the community comes together, right? It's a cultural hub. It's an event space. It's a place for children to learn through interactive classes. So our libraries definitely continue to play a very important role in our communities. Very true.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I want to take the opportunity to dive in a little bit more into your book itself. And
all right.
I'm hoping that you can start by telling our listeners, how do you define the American dream?
Well, I think that's a good question. And if I have a confession to make, that is that that's something I had to redefine several times in the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
What I boil it down to is the American dream is about economic and social mobility. And it is about the ability to get ahead in a sense of prosperity and wealth creation, certainly. But I think the new version that I put forward is that It's that. I'm not disparaging wealth and not taking a thing away from its role in the American dream. But I add to that that we need to have a broader sense of well-being that includes education, lifelong learning. It includes healthcare. It includes your community being a safe place for your kids, for everybody. So we need to think about that quality of life dimension that surrounds prosperity. Because if we let that erode, prosperity, jobs, businesses, all the things that economic developers typically do is lost. But I think the American dream is moving in that direction. And if you look at the generational shift that we see in recent generations, X, Y, Z, you know, there's a whole different take on what that means. But I think it's just a really incredible concept. It's an ideal. And I believe in ideals. I think it's so embedded in what America is and has been from colonial times. And I think it is undergirded by freedom, democracy, and this reality that we are a republic. Without those three things, the American dream ceases to exist. So we need to think about the American dream in that context, as opposed to just, okay, I want to make more money, get a better job, my kids go to a better school, we get a better house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. And I think it is interesting to look at it through the lens of how the American dream and the definition of that has changed over time. And, you know, it's interesting because you made a point earlier how we can't look at what we're facing today through maybe an old lens or an old framework, right? And whether you're defining freedom, which that definition in America has changed dramatically over time, right?
Yes.
Or you're defining the American dream. There is an evolution of that, right? It's not necessarily the house in the suburbs and the two cars in the driveway, although, you know, that is important to many people. I think that quality of life aspect is really interesting. And we're seeing a lot of those changes, as you mentioned, with the younger generation, where people aren't just looking at a job to make more money, but how is that job per se going to impact my lifestyle?
Yes, very much so. And I think that, you know, I have two sons who are both in their early 40s, and I have three grandsons who range in age from 15 to 6 to 2. And they're all very different, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have a whole different lens on what the American dream is about and value in their lives. Both of my sons have great jobs. One is a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and the other is a vice president of IT for J.P. Morgan Chase down in Columbus. And they have different concepts about, you know, what it means, but it's very different than mine. I mean, they see the life-work balance. They know that they mm-hmm. have to work hard and they have to move ahead, but they see family as being so central to everything that they do. So they've got a better sense of balance around that. And I think that when we look even, you know, further ahead, you know, you're going to see things change. And I think people are going to vote in line with some of those generational values. So that's going to be an important thing to watch as we look at this upcoming presidential election.
Yeah, and I think even more so when you look at local politics, you know, who, you know, your local politician, right? And people are voting a lot based on their values, their sense of what matters. And, you mm-hmm. know, that's something as economic developers, obviously, I view the role of an economic developer as a very political role, even though everyone has to stay apolitical. And the reason I say that is because, like an elected official, you are constantly balancing the needs of diverse stakeholder groups. And, you know, the generational needs is something that you hit on. And I think that that in and of itself is interesting. For example, you know, maybe 10 years ago in economic development, people, I would bring up childcare frequently, and probably because of my situatedness in life. I have mm-hmm. a fairly large family, and 10 years ago, you would have caught me square in the middle of needing childcare for younger kids. And a lot of economic developers, especially older ones, were kind of like, yeah, you know, that's really just an issue for people in the social space or the nonprofit space. That's not really an issue for us. And that has completely changed, where
Yes.
childcare is a massive issue. And I think that's in part because of the generational need, right?
Yes.
The need to attract that younger talent and that lack of childcare has made it imperative for businesses who need to grow their workforce. And that
Yes.
really goes back to that balance, I think, that holistic lens of the American dream, because I think if the jobs are there, but you can't find the childcare or the good schools or the safe environment for your families, people don't feel like they have achieved their goals. That's a very interesting point you bring up.
Well, and I really loved what you said about how politics and economic development intersect. I've always seen economic development as political economy. You read The Economist, right?
Right.
So that view is often expressed through the articles that you see published from a European perspective. But I think in many ways economic development is applied political economy. And you're right. I think at almost any cost, the economic development professional has to be apolitical in the sense of not wanting to divide the community around, partisanship and, essentially lose deals over that or lose the ability to bring people together to support some kind of a development project or strategy. But it is very political. Joe Roman used to be the president and CEO of the Greater Cleveland Partnership. And I interviewed him some time ago. And I said, what is the essence of the Greater Cleveland Partnership and similar organizations around the country? And he sat back for a minute and he said, Don, we are platforms for influence, which means this is essentially, a configuration of leadership, power in the community, and wealth to make certain things happen. And he went on to say that our view of that has changed. It's not just about making, the people that sit around our board table happy. There's a recognition that we need to consider the community in a much more inclusive way. And I will never forget that. And I always appreciated his observation about that and his candor, because that's a big part of what economic development organizations do, either consciously and in some cases unconsciously. But politics is important. And that's a message I send in my book, is don't give up on our political system. It's too dear. It's way too important. And it's always been fragmented. This is, I mean, we have more fragmentation and extremism than I think we've seen in a long time. But to be honest with you, that's the nature of the beast. Democracy, a lot of times, is not easy, but I'll take that any day over authoritarianism.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's important to be involved in the process, at the very most basic local level, to the national level. Our vote is our power. It's interesting. And I want to obviously stay clear of anything on this podcast that would be
Of
partisan. I just
course.
want to make that clear to all of our listeners.
Sure.
So I think it's more about the institution of democracy, right?
Yes.
We took our kids to Philadelphia a couple weekends ago, and we went to the Liberty Bell exhibit, and I showed our three daughters. We have seven kids, by the way, but I showed our three daughters the pictures of women in the suffragette movement and how they were, ringing the bell to remind people they still had not obtained suffrage, the ability to vote. And it's something that I think we take for granted in our modern society, the fact that we all do have that ability. But it was hard fought, hard earned. And so as an institution, we do need to continue to protect our ability to be a free and democratic society. So
Yes.
very, very good point.
Yes, I would agree 100%. And that must have been a beautiful experience to take your children to Philadelphia to see the Liberty Bell. There are so many great things in American history that, a lot of children only have the opportunity to read about it. And in some cases, they can't even do that, let alone go there and see it and to touch it. You can't touch it, but you can be close to it.
Yeah, they'll definitely get mad at you if you try to touch it, but it's great to see history come alive. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
Now, speaking of history, right? We know that the American dream has been something that brought people here. You talked about your ancestors coming over in, I think you said 1904, right?
Correct. Yes.
And we still have that desire, right? To explore new things and to create the right situation for our families. And some communities have really gotten it right. They've made it easier for people to achieve that dream. Do you cover any examples like that in your book of communities that you feel are doing a good job of bringing it together for people?
I really don't focus down on specific communities, but I've thought a lot about that issue. And my first comment is that the American dream manifests in different ways in communities. Communities develop, if you will, a certain set of patterns. There's a certain way that they exist and they are. So, you know, when you think about the American dream and how it manifests itself, you know, again, there's through the cultural lens, as we were talking about earlier. Think of Granville, Ohio, which is where Denison University is. That's in the Columbus metropolitan area. Lots of people have retired, moved back there. It's a college town. It has a high quality of life. It's safe. It's stable. It's close to Columbus, which is a go-to metropolitan area. So I think the American dream takes that form, okay? When you think especially about the retiree. But I think of Boulder, Colorado. I think of Boulder, it's an expensive place to live. You know, we visited some friends in Denver and just for fun, you know, looked at the price of houses, if you can find one. But what an interesting place that combines, you know, this big educational center, the University of Colorado, and all the amenities that go with that, but also the natural amenities, you know, to be able to ski and to hike and do, you know, all kinds of wonderful outdoor things. So it manifests a different way there. I think of Naples, Florida, where a lot of our friends have retired or they have second homes. And, you know, for many, it's that span of January through March. If you live in Cleveland and you want to avoid those kind of times of weather, you know, Naples is a great place. But, you know, you have to have some financial resources to be able to do that. It's a beautiful place and it's grown. But the American dream is manifested there for a lot of retirees and other folks that, you know, let's say in the 50s and up range, even though there's a lot of younger people, but, you know, places tend to attract certain kind of people. But I think of so many places. I worked in Chico, California on an economic development strategy with a great friend of mine, Mark Waterhouse, Garnet Consulting. You might know Mark. He and I worked together on many projects in Ohio and many other states. But the Chico project just struck us. What an amazing place to go to school, to live. You know, so the American dream is manifested around that and all the amenities that you find there. But I could go on and on and on. There's places, Franklin, Pennsylvania. Small town. I got to know Northwest Pennsylvania quite well after working on about seven different county and community economic development strategies. But Franklin is just this really beautiful, quaint little place, high quality of life, and it attracts people. And people live there and live around it. But I think it's important to look at, again, the culture, look at what you want out of life, and what's the place that materializes. So that's how I would answer that question. I worked in a lot of wonderful places in my career, and I learned to find the beauty in each, whether it's Tucson or Phoenix, Seattle. You know, there's just some amazing things in Madisonville, Kentucky, or Elkhart, Indiana. You know, your drive and determination to realize the American dream can be possible in a lot of those places if it fits with your values, your resources, and the people you're connected to.
I think that's one of the great benefits of living in our country is our country is so large and there are so many opportunities to really customize your lifestyle based on what your value system is and based on what your needs and interests are, to your point. So it is interesting. I think, you know, if you don't like where you live, there's a lot of this country left to explore. Now, one of the things obviously we talk about is if you can't afford where you live, there's communities with great job opportunities and maybe a lower cost of living, which can help. Now, speaking of cost of living, obviously,
Yes.
cost of living is something that is really put the squeeze on a lot of people, especially the middle class and working class folks. So, the American dream, I don't know that we can escape some of those foundational ideas that there is a level of being financially secure, that does make that possible. Whether or not your value system is financial wealth or, health is wealth or cultural amenities is wealth, that basic needs being met, that financial security, I think is something that's very pivotal. And,
It
what do you
is.
think is hindering people's ability to have that and therefore achieve the American dream for themselves?
So I'm going to share with you something right out of my book here. I'm not going to bore your listeners with the details, but I did an analysis of real per capita personal income adjusted for cost of living. So I did this on a state basis just because I didn't want to, have 16 tables in there that made the point. But the state that was number one when you adjust real per capita personal income for cost of living is North Dakota. So, if you look at the real per capita income for North Dakota on average is $68,000. But when you adjust it for cost of living, that $68,000 is worth about $78,000. Okay. And then you go down the list here and to a lot of states that really are high cost places to live. It gets quite interesting because they're great places, but you better have a lot of money because it costs a lot and your buying power is going to be less if you live in New York City compared to, let's say, Indianapolis. So the analysis also looked because it does analyze politics, and this is not a political statement on my part, but actually red states did better on that index than blue states.
Yeah, and I think a state by state comparison is definitely interesting for folks, especially if they're looking at things from a regional perspective. But yeah, that ability to have financial security, of course, is so important. And that's why economic developers, the role of creating those jobs that actually can provide for a family is so critically important. And I think that ties back into even the manufacturing conversation we were having earlier.
Absolutely is. So you're well aware of the stigma that's been associated with manufacturing for many years and how difficult. Like we many years ago we started a machine trades institute because there was a shortage of people that were machinists that could work for Cleveland Twist Drill or Warner and Swayze or North American Acme or any of these companies that were known for doing great work, in the machine tool industry. And the stigma prevented so many people from wanting to do that. Well, I want to go to college and get a 4-year degree. You don't want to
Sure.
make an incredible amount of money and have great benefits and be able to do all kinds of things. And a lot of people said, no, I don't want to do that. I want to go get a 4-year degree, which is really a point of discussion in today's world when you look at the affordability of higher education and its payoff, right? So my position, I'm a university professor, okay? And I teach students all over the world, by the way. So what I have to say about the American dream is very different in the context of whether you're in Malta or you're in Ghana or whether you're in Dubai. And that's where I have, PhD dissertation students right now. So the American dream is very different for them. But, I think that we have it so good. And my biggest concern as I think about America is that we don't allow ourselves to be torn apart, that we find a way to accept that differences are okay. It's okay to be of this religious faith. It's okay to, want to be single and living in New York City. It's okay if you want to have, a family and you want to be surrounded by, your extended family and live in an environment. That's where it's all about. But we have to learn to accept that people are different and that that's the heart of what America is, so that we don't seek this sameness and this routinization of human beings because we destroy what made this country so great in the first place.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of strength in our plurality of opinions. And, you know, we talk about economic developers needing to bring diverse stakeholders together. And I think I'm seeing that a lot more now is the interest in bringing people with diverse backgrounds, varying ages, diverse interests together to come up with ideas for where communities should go, you know, or what should be tackled with a particular initiative. And you're right, we need to make sure that we listen to all those voices and give equal weight to them, because it's going to make us better.
Yes. So what was economic development like when I started back in the late 1970s? It was all the old white guys that were sitting at the table. I mean, I'm a good one to talk, right? I got all white hair. But I think that was the model. And so there were no women that sat at the boardroom table. Very few women were hired as economic development professionals. And very few of the people that were hired in those jobs had college degrees. Situation's totally different. If you look at any of the basic economic development courses, look at EDI, look at the conferences that IEDC puts on, you know, it's totally different now. And it just delights me to see, you know, all those different faces, personalities, backgrounds, because I think that's how we develop a better America and a better American dream, is by having those kind of professionals, you know, out there doing what they do. But it was totally different when I started.
Yeah, it's definitely changed. And that's why I even mentioned in the past decade, there's been so much change that's happened in the industry. And I think it has the ability to make a broader impact than economic development as an industry ever has, because we are looking at communities in a more holistic way. And, yes. And therefore, obviously, incorporating the needs of all of our community members rather than yes. a select few. Now, speaking of that, economic developers have to juggle a lot of priorities. And if you're in the industry, you know firsthand how short-staffed most offices are.
Absolutely.
If you're not intimately in the industry, it can look like economic developers have, you know, these huge budgets and the big team. And no, they don't. I mean, it's shocking how you can go into communities and maybe have two people in an office where you would not expect
yes.
that. With so much to do and so few people to work on it, if an economic developer really wants to prioritize making the American dream more attainable in their community, what should be maybe the one or two things you think they could focus on to make a good impact?
Well, I'm going to say this, but I know this is already the case already, which is the emphasis on workforce development and relevant education is number one. You know, I remember a day when people followed jobs. Now jobs follow people with talent and knowledge and skills. So that's kind of where we are today. And of course, we've overlaid that with the whole world of remote work, which changes the dynamics of place and work and people who, you know, play different roles in the workplace. But I think education and workforce development really are the central thing. And I think most economic developers see the rising importance of that, and they're doing a lot about it. So I think that's good news. The other thing is really helping communities develop and use the strategic intelligence to know how different layers of change will affect the community. So that's a strategic planning objective in some ways with an environmental scan. But it's about getting the kind of intelligence that's much more alive, that tells you specifically how certain developments and events, how regulatory changes at the state level will affect communities in certain ways. But to understand those things in a specific context, because, you know, the impacts from the outside world, whether it's the things that we started out talking about in terms of manufacturing and reshoring, or even our supply chain, in many cases that remain, you know, very globally rooted. When we disrupt those things, as we learned from the pandemic, you know, it creates a whole set of ripple effects and things that affect very specific communities in specific ways. But to have the kind of intelligence, and I think that's where artificial intelligence and all the quantum computing tools and things that are now being brought down to Earth can help. And I think another big term that I'll use, and I'll try to make it as simple as possible, is the role of complexity science, the kind of work that the Santa Fe Institute and many other centers, Johns Hopkins has a major emphasis on complexity science and medicine. But it's understanding, as we were talking about, the whole picture, you know, being holistic and understanding how things emerge as a result of the collective interactions. Science has been rooted in reductionism for years. That's how I was trained. You develop a hypothesis, you test it, you control. And a lot of times all you find through regression analysis is what? It's correlated, but it isn't causation. But I think where complexity science is coming is going to be of a huge benefit to all these understaffed economic development organizations who can tap into some powerful tools and be able to figure out how things are going to affect their world. So I think that's a big thing. I think that's a huge thing. Strategic intelligence tied to technology in an adaptable way, usable way, alongside education and workforce. That's what I would put my money in.
Interesting answer. I'm going to have to look at the work being done at the Santa Fe Institute now.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
Yeah, and that definitely is a really good point, is that ability to continue to utilize the tools that are available to us to understand our communities, understand change at a deeper issue, a deeper level, really.
Yes. Yes, and real time.
Mm-hmm.
Real time. I think that's the key. The transportation industry has moved in that direction. I think we do a lot better job of real-time modeling of transportation systems. So there's some really valuable things that we can learn from that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's just, you know, and sometimes I worry about there's so many things that we need to learn and do that we feel overwhelmed. So, you know, and this is on a personal side, I'll mention this, Bethany. You know, I'm a mindfulness instructor. I did this for 7 years. I taught mindfulness to cancer patients and their families. Did this on a part-time basis. And I think mindfulness, you know, however you choose to understand that, I understand it, you know, in the sense that MIT brought it about. It was really something that could be tied into our everyday lives in a practical way, that to be mindful, not lose track of ourselves, you know, understand who we are and be able to come from that space to approach the world every day. And so I think as we think about this world of constant change, we need something that centers us. Meditation is not for everybody, but mindfulness is something that anybody can learn to do and apply in their everyday life.
Yeah, I actually recommend for anyone who wants to look into that, reading the works of Dr. Ellen Langer, because she really, you know, pioneered mindfulness, Western mindfulness, as she calls it, right? The ability to notice novel change.
Yes.
Yeah, she's brilliant. I actually took her class at Harvard and really, really enjoyed it. But the mindfulness is something
How fortunate that you were able to do that. That's great.
Yeah, she's still teaching it. Anybody wants to sign up?
Cool. Well, nobody wants to sign up?
If anyone listening wants to sign up, they can.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. That's a great plug. Yeah, sign up. But I think, you know, I think we were talking earlier about manufacturing, the human side of enterprise and all the things that we learn, you know, in our management training. But I think that just understanding who we are and showing up in the world in an authentic way is important. You know, one of the big things that we teach at Transcontinental University is emotional intelligence. And that has a huge bearing on how well we navigate, you know, our business world as entrepreneurs, small business owners, or working in a large corporation, you know, a large nonprofit, whether you work for the military. We had students that really are still in the military as, you know, senior officers. And emotional intelligence is so important. So alongside all that stuff that we teach them about quantitative methods and management strategies and all that kind of stuff, learning emotional intelligence and being able to practice that and to grow is so important.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you're right. That's definitely helpful for economic developers, right? Is again, you're working with that diverse group of stakeholders. And is that a course that any economic developer could sign up to take from you?
probably not a transcontinental unless they're enrolled as a student, but could I help them into that area? I certainly could, because I believe in it so much. And, you know, when you reach this point in your career, I mean, you have to kind of figure out ways that you can give to the world. My ways of giving to the world right now are teaching and writing and speaking. But I don't, there was a time when I used to worry about the honorarium I would get paid to, you know, teach someplace. And, you know, I just make it available. Yeah. It's a gift that you've been given. So I would welcome anybody who wants to talk about emotional intelligence, wants to talk about mindfulness, wants to talk about all those kind of things, because it's it gives me a joy. It really does.
That's awesome. And I so appreciate you being willing to offer that to our listeners. And we are going to play a game here in a second. Before we do, why don't you tell everyone the best way to reach you, to get a copy of your book?
Okay. So my website address is donaldyanone.com. I'm going to spell that. It's DonaldYanone.com. And there's plenty of mechanisms on that website to reach me and to learn more about my work. So that's how to get to me. And the book is available on Amazon and probably, oh my God, it's available because of the global distribution. It's available in many places. Amazon is the best place to get it, though. And it's America's dream at a crossroads, the 2024 presidential election and beyond. And very shortly, we're going to be talking about the beyond aspect of that. And that's where my invited talks after the election will focus, because the election will be passed and we will have a new president.
Yeah, definitely. November's coming up before you know it. All right. Well, I do recommend everyone definitely go and visit your website. We had a great conversation today, and there's so much more information there and resources, along with additional books that you've written. I visited myself. But we are at a point where we're going to play our Shovel Toss game. I don't know if you're familiar with this game as an avid listener, which I'm sure you are, but I'm going to ask you 10 questions and you're going to answer as quickly as possible. Okay.
So you want me to answer the 10 questions?
You got it.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yep.
Let me
and
take a deep breath.
You got to answer them as quickly as possible, and I'm going to time you.
All right.
All right. Ready?
Ready.
Set. Go. First car.
First car, 54 Dodge red and white.
Favorite dessert?
Chocolate ice cream.
If you could be a superhero, who would you be?
Probably Albert Einstein, with a sense of how to get things done.
Favorite vacation destination?
Oh my gosh, anywhere on the ocean.
Book you're reading right now?
So I'm reading some of Steinbeck's Red Ponies and all those old books, believe it or not, rereading.
Top of your bucket list?
Top of my bucket list is to take the family someplace that everybody wants to go, and whether that's in the U.S. or someplace, and we haven't figured that out, but it's a family thing, whole family, go and do.
Go-to song,
Let It Be.
Something you can't live without?
Love.
What you wish you would have known when you started your career?
That I needed to listen more and talk less.
What you want to be remembered for?
That I was a real person.
Good job. Okay, so you did all of that in a minute and 16 seconds. Our average is a minute 30. So I would say your mindfulness is paying off, because you clearly know yourself well. You know yourself 15 seconds better.
Thank you. I keep learning every day. That I like that. That's a great thing to do with your guests. It really is. That's nice.
Well, it's fun because you don't have time to think. So these are very off the cuff answers, for sure.
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, I hope that you and your family find that ideal vacation destination soon. As you mentioned earlier when we were chatting, you have some pretty diverse ages when you count in the grandkids. So I imagine that it probably adds to the complexity of that decision.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I have greatly appreciated our discussion and hearing your insights. And I do encourage everyone to go visit your website and learn more about your book.
Bethany, you're so kind. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it. You're a great host, and you made this a wonderful adventure.
That's good. Well, thanks, Don. We'll chat soon.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you, Bethany. Our internal Golden Shovel marketing team has been very busy lately. As we come to the end of Q3, most of you are probably aware that our focus was on the aviation industry. You can check out the recording of our webinar, Runways to Revenue, Unlocking the Economic Potential of Your Airport. And then we also had a podcast. We had a discussion with Kyle Wensman, a certified flight instructor, on that very topic. And then also you can download an ebook as well. We've got webinars already booked. If you go to their Golden Shovel Resource Learning Center, we have Succession Planning for Economic Development Leaders coming up at the end of September this month. And also Retail Recruitment Playbook, Game-Changing Strategies for Cities, that's coming up in very early October. Also, if you are a Golden Shovel client, you probably are aware of the new AI tools that have been built into the Economic Gateway. These are awesome. Trust me, as one who works in the Economic Gateway often, I use them a lot. They are wonderful. What an awesome addition to our Economic Gateway. If you are a Golden Shovel client and you were not able to attend the webinar, please connect with your gatekeeper. You can get a recording of that webinar, and then you can check out the slides from that webinar as well. And also, hey, talk to your gatekeeper. They can show you how it works. Awesome tools. Golden Shovel social media, like us at Shovel Toss, Twitter, follow us at Gold Shovel, LinkedIn, follow us as well, Golden Shovel. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and also check us out on TikTok, Golden Shovel Agency. We have just finished a recording with a great Golden Shovel client. We'll get that edited soon and released. And with that, thank you for listening to the latest episode of Shovel Talk.